Those sales have increased significantly as the result of bipartisan congressional legislation. And on trade, she said that unfair U.S. policies were harming China's just interests and constraining China's high-quality development. These issues remain on the table, showing that summit diplomacy is insufficient to overcome the major policy differences. After their meeting, Biden was asked if he still thought Xi was a dictator, referring to a previous time when Biden had called him that. Biden replied this time, "Well, look, he is." That gaffe aside, the real problems in trying to reset U.S.-China relations are the same they have always been. Even if all the agreements are carried out, human rights, trade, Taiwan, military competition, and divergent conceptions of national security will keep tensions high for years to come. Unless, of course, the mindsets of leaders in both countries shift dramatically. I'm Mel Dertal for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 21st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for an update on the Portland teachers' strike with KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. As the Portland teachers' strike moves into its historic fourth week, the Portland Association of Teachers and PPS inch closer to agreement, but efforts continue to stall. According to the union, the bargaining teams had reached a tentative agreement early Sunday morning, but the school board rejected the deal, citing concerns over parent involvement in class sizes. On Tuesday morning, thousands of Portland's teachers and their supporters temporarily took over the Burnside Bridge, calling for a fair contract, more staffing, and safer schools. KBOO's Isabel Charlet caught up with some of the striking teachers, including Portland Association of Teachers President Angela Bonilla.
Yeah, I am in the back of a pickup truck with two speakers tied to it with Jackie Dixon, my VP. I'm looking back at a crowd of thousands of community members, teachers, students, kids, heading towards the Burnside Bridge. We're about to take it over. I see signs with board member names and phone numbers because they need to understand the urgency of the moment and not get on a plane to take their Thanksgiving break while 40,000 students sit uncertain about what next week will look like.
And what's your motivation for taking the bridge?
Our motivation is that for one day of an unnecessary strike was one day too long. Going into a fourth week is unconscionable. We do not want to be on strike. We want to be with our students at school, and we need this district to take this bargaining seriously. It has been a mess since the beginning. The trust is gone. They need to accept the agreement that we have come to with the superintendent and their bargaining team. If he can't make them take the deal, then who has the power here? And if it's the board, they need to step up and do the right thing. I'm just so grateful for the city standing up for our kids and for our teachers. And it chokes me up every time I start thinking about it because we're going to win the schools our kids need. So
awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
I'm Joanna Perez.
What do you teach?
I teach 7th grade humanities. You know, the disparity, even the foundation of the schools,
it's very clear the divide between the East and the West, you know? And where do our children of color live? I want them to put the children first, put the teachers first. That's what they're here for. And it seems like it's just like they're playing fake politics for show.
My name is Claudia Caminati. When I showed up as a dual immersion Spanish teacher, I realized that I was not assigned to the classes that I was told I was gonna teach. I was given classes that were outside of my endorsement and expected to complete them. And I was assigned to 34 kids with only 32 desks. So at that moment, I realized that it goes far beyond from what people and some parents are aware of. And not until you're inside the classroom that you realize that it's a system that it's not sustainable and change needs to happen.
Yeah, my name is Heather Stearns. I'm a special education TOSA teacher on special assignments. I'm really looking for caps on caseload sizes for our special education classrooms, especially our focus classrooms, which serve our students with the highest needs. The ratio of students to teachers is like far out of control right now. We need a lot more staffing in those classrooms. It's very, very stressful. We have new educators entering these roles and they don't get the support they need and they leave very quickly because they don't have our support. So it's hard. It's really, really hard.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And my name's Eric.
And what school do you teach at?
I teach at Beaumont Middle School.
Do you think you could describe, like, what are some of the most significant challenges that you see your students facing?
Mental health supports. The kids who need the mental health supports about the most, they aren't there. So many of our kids are going through times of trauma, and that trauma impacts them adversely, and we as teachers work with them to provide all the supports that we have available. It's never enough.
Maria Kidder, and my position is Learning Center at George Middle School. So we both have to serve 11,580 minutes in 3,150 minutes of instructional time. So obviously impossible. Yeah.
And what does that feel like for you, just on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, really hard. Honestly, painful. Because we love our students so much and we can't serve all of their minutes, unfortunately.
And what would be your message to the district?
I think stop exploiting students and teachers. I think make sure that we are staffed correctly, especially for our most vulnerable students.
That was KBOO's Isabel Charlet reporting on the Portland teacher strike. You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On November 14th, the U.S. government released the 5th National Climate Assessment. It's a comprehensive report that looks at how climate change has impacted communities around the U.S. and the impact that future warming will have on ecosystems and the economy. The findings are broken down by region, and warming looks different in different parts of the country. Dr. Deepti Singh is an assistant professor at the University of Washington, Vancouver, and one of the authors of the report. Dr. Singh says it's important to understand that every community in the country is seeing the impacts of climate change.
At this point, we have very clear evidence that human activities are warming the planet and that global warming is affecting us here in the U.S. today. Nearly every region in the U.S. is being impacted by changing climate conditions, even though it might vary depending on where you live. For example, if you're in one of the western states, you might be seeing warmer and drier conditions more often. But if you live in somewhere along the east coast, you might see more wetter conditions. But every state and every community in the U.S. is being impacted by the effects of a changing climate. And climate change is affecting every resource that we depend on, from food, energy, and water resources to ecosystems that we rely on, as well as our health.
A warming world also creates more extreme weather events. Their impacts can compound, and Dr. Singh says that can make it more difficult for communities to recover and build resilience.
We're seeing an increase in many different types of extremes affecting the U.S. In particular, we're seeing an increase in the frequency and severity of heat waves across the western U.S. We're also seeing unprecedented drought in the southwest. And the combination of extreme heat and drought are increasing the risk of severe wildfires in the western U.S. In the eastern U.S., we're seeing the opposite, where we're seeing more extreme precipitation events and heavier rainfall associated with tropical cyclones and thunderstorms that bring most of the rainfall to the region. Now, in addition to this, we're seeing events, because they're becoming more frequent, we're seeing these events affect communities without much time given for communities to recover, which means they have compounding effects. And we're also seeing these events happen simultaneously. For example, in 2020, we had simultaneous large wildfires burning across the western U.S., while we had a record-breaking Atlantic hurricane season in the east, which really stretched emergency management resources and our ability to respond to all these simultaneous disasters that were happening.
The fifth National Climate Assessment also takes a direct look at how the climate crisis will impact frontline groups, particularly low-income people and people of color. Dr. Leslie Ann Dupigny-Giroux is the Vermont State climatologist and one of the report's authors. She says frontline communities face more risk of harm because of compound hazards.
Some of the groups that will be particularly affected by all of the changes that we're seeing as climate continues to change, including extreme weather events and flooding, droughts, wildfires, tornadoes, all those pieces are communities that are at the front line of all of these various hazards as they increase in intensity and frequency. Communities who may not have the same level of access to resources, and then all of the various challenges that come along with what we call compound hazards, which are hazards that take place either one after the other sequentially or similarly at the same time. And so if you don't have access to either information or resources or materials, then it poses that additional constraint on how you can either adapt to, mitigate against, or even just do day-to-day living with some of these natural hazards that we're seeing.
Dr. Singh agrees, and she notes the impact that more extreme weather events and hotter days has on indigenous food sources.
We're not all experiencing the impacts of changing climate conditions equally. Communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous people are some of the most disproportionately affected by climate change and extreme events. And I'll give you an example from where I'm located in the Pacific Northwest. Here, indigenous communities, their livelihoods, their food sources, as well as their lands that they have close attachments to are being threatened by climate risks. We're seeing shifts in huckleberries, we're seeing salmon populations being severely affected by heat and drought, and these are really important. They have important cultural value as well as are important sources of food for these communities.
The report focuses on how different communities are impacted to different degrees, and it highlights that the response to the climate crisis needs to take that into consideration. Dr. Rachel Schwamm is a professor at Rutgers University, another author of the report.
Climate change is absolutely impacting different groups of people in different ways. And we know many communities in the U.S. are already shouldering high levels of environmental pollution. They struggle economically. They have high levels of social hardships as well. And these communities will often feel the impacts of climate change more severely. Climate change will worsen the living conditions of these communities and increase inequality between communities. So one example, you can imagine lower income communities, communities of color, have overall less investment in infrastructure. And so, for example, stormwater management is less invested in, there are less green spaces. And these are both important in managing heavy rains because it gives the water someplace to go. And with less of these mechanisms there to absorb the rain, the flooding is worse. Add to this less availability, less access to safe housing, or less access to transportation to leave flooding areas, and you're going to experience a lot more human suffering in those communities than others with better water infrastructure and access to housing and transportation.
U.S. emissions are declining, but not nearly fast enough to stop the climate crisis or to meet the nation's climate change commitments. The report emphasizes the importance of a just transition to a low-carbon future. Dr. Schwamm explains what that entails.
So a just transition is responding to climate change while taking into account why some people are suffering more than others and trying to make sure that the costs of adaptation and mitigation aren't just borne on the backs of those who are already suffering, you know, the working poor who can't afford more costs to be laid upon them. And so it means ensuring that these people get equitable job access in the new clean energy economy. It means making sure that low carbon energy is affordable and accessible to all, and that we're not just putting increasing energy costs on top of people. And it means addressing climate change, you know, unfortunately, is not free. It's going to be costly to transition our energy system. And so a just transition is one where the distribution of costs and benefits can really be addressing current inequalities.
The climate assessment will have political impacts too. Agencies around the country can use it to guide future development and restoration projects. Dr. Schwamm says it's a powerful tool for prioritizing what needs to be done.
I have three most important take-home points for this. The first is that all of the U.S. is increasing the number of actions to address climate change, and this is occurring in all regions where we're both mitigating and adapting. The second is that even with these actions, we must continue to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions through replacing fossil fuels with low carbon energies. And we need to keep this going until we are net zero, which means that for every unit of greenhouse gases we are putting into the atmosphere, we take out an equal amount. And finally, the third is that even with reaching net zero, we must continue to advance our knowledge and action on intelligent adaptation to reduce the impacts of climate change and lower our harms. And these actions can include things like implementing things along our shorelines, like coastal wetlands or oyster reefs that reduce our shoreline erosion from major storms, and things like upgrading stormwater infrastructure to account for heavier rainfalls that we're going to see.
The rollout of the fifth National Climate Assessment is pretty different from the last one, which was completed under the Trump administration in 2018. It was buried in the headlines on Black Friday and didn't garner much attention. This time, there's a podcast detailing the report, an art series, and a poetry anthology. People can explore the data on their own through a virtual atlas, and a full text of the report is available in Spanish too. The fifth National Climate Assessment can be found online at globalchange.gov. This is KBOO News In Depth. In August of 1945, in preparation for the Nazi war crimes trials, the victorious Allied powers, the US, the Soviet Union, Britain, and France, produced a document called the London Charter of the International Military Tribunal, which became known as the Nuremberg Charter in reference to the German city where the main trials would take place. Some commentators believe the charter has great relevance for the situation we're now witnessing in Gaza. Richard Drake is a history professor at the University of Montana who recently wrote about the importance of the Charter for Counterpunch. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
So the Nuremberg Charter, the relevance to the situation in Gaza. I mean, some people would say that Nuremberg was winner's justice and they didn't really deal with the Allied crimes, you know, the firebombing of the German and Japanese cities, the dropping of the atomic bombs. So how legitimate can such a charter be, or such an example of putting people on trial be?
I would say all of those criticisms of the Nuremberg Charter are accurate, they're legitimate, but the section of the charter that I cited in the essay that you've read, dealing with crimes against humanity, really is the moral high point of that document. And I think it serves as a model for the kind of thinking we should be employing about war crimes today, and especially with regard to what's going on in Gaza right now. So I think you're right. I mean, there are some flaws in the Nuremberg Charter. Victor's justice is a very accurate way to think of it, but there are elements in it, I think, that rise above the flaws and really have been used, I think, ever since as a kind of exemplary standard for the way we should think about war crimes.
And the section that you're referring to, crimes against humanity, would that conform pretty much to what we think of as international law on that subject?
I think it influenced international law a great deal, especially Article 6 of the Nuremberg Charter and the portion of that article dealing with crimes against humanity really shines a bright light, I think, on the whole question of war crimes and how we should think about them.
And then there are people on the pro-Palestinian side who would say the issue is simple. There is oppressor and oppressed, subjugated and subjugator, colonized and colonizer, and they, the other side, are responsible for war crimes. We are merely engaging in resistance. So how do you respond to that argument?
I think that there is a great deal to be said for that argument, but the point in the Nuremberg Charter that I think is highly relevant today, and especially with regard to Gaza, is that violence of the kind happening in Gaza today against civilians is always immoral, no matter who employs it. And if we follow that principle, the criticism of the Likud government in Israel is understandable, but also the attack on Israeli civilians on October 7th also would be ruled out by the logic and the ethical standards employed by the Nuremberg Charter. And I think that's a legitimate point, that civilians should not be targeted in the way that they are being targeted in Gaza right now by Israel, or the way they were targeted by Hamas on October 7th. Both of those actions would be proscribed by the Nuremberg Charter, Article 6, Crimes Against Humanity section.
Yeah, I think what Hamas has said is, well, we didn't set out to kill all those people. We just wanted the hostages. Do you think that has any validity? Or doesn't it matter because they killed all those people?
And if we follow the language of the Nuremberg Charter, it's a remorselessly unforgiving language that we find here. Civilians, children, women, old people, they are to be protected from the kind of violence that is coming from both, that came from both sides on October 7th from the Palestinian side, Hamas side, and ever since then from the Israeli side. Violence against civilians is always wrong. That's the argument of the document. I think it's a principle that deserves to be honored.
It's a slightly different but related subject. What do you make of the way the Biden administration is handling this? They do seem to make statements about protecting civilians, but how serious is that if they're so supportive of Israel?
Not very serious, in my view. I think that the administration has made a tragic mistake, a tragic miscarriage of justice and ethics and mercy by going along with the terror bombing of Gaza. Just how I see that activity right now. You cannot be dropping 2,000-pound bombs on refugee centers full of small children and expect the world to applaud you and to think of you as a defender of democracy and liberty and freedom, which is what we're trying to claim we're doing. I think it's an absurd argument, and I think it's going to backfire on us. And all over the world, and particularly the global South, the negative reaction to American policies in supporting Likud in Gaza is really generating a lot of blowback. It's a famous term that Chalmers Johnson used in his marvelous blowback trilogy of some years ago. It's so much of the terrorism that the United States faces in the world, Johnson argued in those books, really comes from blowback to our own policies. I think this is a very important way to think about the problem of terrorism in the world today.
Yeah, I guess some people like Noam Chomsky would even argue that the number one terrorist is the U.S. and not those other countries.
His colleague, man with whom he wrote many books over the years, Edward Herman, I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Manufacturing Consent, yeah.
Yeah, and they wrote a Manufacturing Consent is the great book. Another book that Herman wrote that really comes to mind as you raise his name, was the real terror network. A book he wrote in the early Reagan years, the early 1980s, the role of the United States, he was particularly interested in the CIA and the nefarious work that the CIA conducted worldwide, undermining governments, sowing the seeds of terrorism worldwide. That's a powerful book, and I think a very legitimate argument that he makes in there about a major source of terrorist activity in the world comes from our side.
Do you remember in 1965, the Suharto coup in Indonesia, and 500,000 people were killed, and that was with CIA complicity, with the Nuremberg Charter cover complicity, as well as the actual killing?
The book to be read on that subject is Vincent Bevins's The Jakarta Method. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I hadn't heard of that. Okay.
Years ago, in which he analyzed that tragic event and emphasized the crucial role that the CIA played in supporting the murder of over a million people.
It was not 500,000. It was over a million.
It was, according to Bevins in his book. Which I recommend all your listeners to read that book. It's a powerful study about really this whole blowback idea that many of our policies have been undertaken in such a way as to generate hatred of the United States worldwide. And we really need to address those causes of terrorism, those domestic causes of terrorism, in addition to being concerned about groups like Hamas and ISIS. We have our own problem within, domestically, internally, on this question of terrorism. And the Jakarta Method really zeroes in on this issue of Indonesia and what happened there in the mid-1960s. It really was a culminating example of CIA intervention that really began in 1953 in Iran.
Was it in Greece even earlier in the 40s?
I think came later. Well, there was an earlier episode, but then in 1967 with the colonels, that was another example of America supporting right-wing reactionary governments. Mm-hmm. Any government was okay so long as it protected the corporate capitalist system.
And it was anti-communist. Yeah.
Yeah. But there was a series of episodes engineered by the CIA, Operation Ajax in Iran, 1954 in Guatemala. That was another major case of United States interference in the democratic politics of foreign countries, something we have been quite vociferous in our accusations against Putin for doing. But we've done plenty of this ourselves. And Indonesia was yet another one of those events, Iran, Guatemala, Indonesia, Greece, and other places as well. But we have a very shabby record in that department.
And I recall Indonesia as well killed off, I think, a third of the East Timorese population. Not too much publicity here about that.
No, that's been safely buried.
Yeah.
We don't look at ourselves in the mirror. That's one of the great critiques of Chalmers Johnson, the great University of California, Berkeley political scientist. In addition to the books we've already mentioned by the Blowback Trilogy, his last book, the book he wrote the year he died, I think he died in 2010 or 11, but the last book he wrote was called Dismantling the Empire, and he meant dismantling the American Empire, which is global, and it is defended by 800 military bases worldwide. And his argument was, until we come to terms with that fundamental imperialist problem of our own, we are on the same path, and he actually uses this example, this historical example, we are on the same path that ancient imperial Rome took to its decline and fall. The great study by Edward Gibbon, which Chalmers Johnson cites at great length in the second volume of the Blowback Trilogy. There's a parallel, there's an historical parallel between what we are doing now in the 20th and 21st centuries and what ancient imperial Rome did 2,000 years ago. and the end will be the same. It will be the same unless we take action against the status quo. Problems of terrorism, problems of imperialism, colonialism, all of these problems are propelling us down the road of catastrophe. And I'm afraid what's happening in Gaza right now, as we speak, is an illustration of that tragedy.
Yeah, I often think of the U.S. as the modern Rome, but some of that is because we have a Senate, and they put a lot of stock in their Senate. I think the Senate is the only institution in the government, or according to the Constitution, that can't be abolished, although it doesn't say so explicitly. That's what it amounts to.
Sometimes they have a pretty good impression of abolishing themselves.
Yeah.
Of their active role in furthering the business of the country.
What do they say? That's the place where the bills go to die.
Indeed.
That was University of Montana Professor Richard Drake speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KABU News In Depth. Thank you for being with us. I'm Althea Billings.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch, that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. And now I'm knee-deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
We've got your goat. On the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, November 24th at 10 a.m., right here on 90.7 KABU.